Good morning. May it please the court, Carmela Keener of Rosenthal, Monheit & Gaddis on behalf of the Appellee Federal Insurance Company. I'd like to introduce to the court my co-counsel, Wallace Christensen, and Merrill Hirsch, both of Trotman Sanders in Washington, D.C. Mr. Christensen will make the presentation today on behalf of the appellee.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Good morning, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. I'm Rick Miller from the Wilmington firm, Ferry, Joseph, and Pierce, and I have the privilege this morning of introducing my co-counsel, Mr. Lawrence Eagle, from the New York firm, Breger, Wexler, Eagle, and Squire. And Mr. Wexler will be presenting argument, Mr. Eagle will be presenting argument on behalf of the appellants.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Lawrence Eagle and I'm a member of the firm of Breger, Wexler, Eagle & Squire. I want to thank the court for the opportunity to present argument this morning on behalf of the appellants, Hilco Capital LP and Congress Financial Corp. As in the briefs, I will refer to Congress and Hilco collectively as Hilco, unless context required otherwise. As I've advised the court clerk, I would like to take 10 minutes for my opening remarks and reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal. Time will not allow me to address all of the arguments that we've raised, that Hilco has raised on this appeal, and for those I don't address, I will be relying on the briefs. I'd like to start out with saying that overall this is an appeal from legal rulings made by the trial court from summary judgment decisions and then jury instructions that followed from the legal rulings during summary judgment. And this morning, this court's going to be asked to review those legal determinations, and under those reviews, the de novo standard would apply. First, I'd like to just provide the court with a little bit of background, as set forth in our brief. This is an insurance coverage dispute. Federal Insurance Company provided excess insurance to the directors and officers of a Missouri-based company known as Payless Cashways. The Tower of Insurance provided for $30 million. The primary insurance was issued by National Union Fire Insurance Company. The first layer of excess was federal insurance, and the third layer was issued by a company called Twin City. Hilco lent money to Payless as a secured lender. In May of 2003, Hilco sued certain of the officers and directors of Payless Cashways, the insureds, federal insureds, National Union insureds, for providing false information in connection with financial information that had been represented to the lenders in order to induce the lenders to provide financial information. And early, we refer to that case as the Barron action. An early attempt to set up, that action was filed in the United States District Court for the Western District of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri. An early attempt to settle the Barron action failed. The parties then engaged in extensive discovery, which concluded in October of 2004. A key development in the Barron action was the discovery by Hilco's forensic accountant of fraudulent journal entries, and those entries were made on a weekly basis, and they were made for a period of about 13 to 14 weeks in which they would inflate the inventory by millions of dollars in cases ranging from at least $7.5 to about $13.5 to $14 million. The entries would be made, certifications would be provided to the lenders with the inflated numbers, and the lenders would lend on those inflated numbers, and then shortly after the entries were made, the journal entries were reversed. This became a key development in the case, and the reason why I'm discussing it now is because the entries were made by a gentleman by the name of David Stout, who was the chief accounting officer at Payless. And Mr. Stout's name appears in certain of the written agreements that are involved.
Counsel, you're claiming that there are at least seven reversible errors that were made in this case, and you've limited yourself to 10 minutes. Is this how you want to spend it?
I was trying to provide the court with a little background. I will move forward. If the court's familiar with the background of the case, then in terms of the issues that are before the court, first, the case was tried on a theory that the entire consent to settle provision in the National Union primary policy was part of the federal consent, part of the federal excess policy, even though the federal excess policy does not contain a requirement that the insureds obtain federal's consent prior to entering into a settlement that might implicate its policy. The trial court concluded, based upon the testimony of David Shea, that because the insured believed that they needed Federal's consent, that the entire consent to settle provision in the National Union policy was part of the Federal policy. As a threshold matter, we've argued and argued to the trial court that the judge that the trial court was wrong in concluding that the consent to settle provision in the National Union policy was part of the Federal excess policy. Federal had an opportunity to provide specific language in its policy.
All right, what is the issue that you're that you're addressing?
The issue that I'm addressing, Your Honor, is that in the absence of a consent to settle, as the case was tried to the jury, the critical fact was the jury was instructed that Federal's consent to settle to a settlement was necessary before the insureds could enter into the settlement, although Federal could not unreasonably withhold its consent provided it was allowed to effectively associate. The entire definition for the consent provision is drawn from National Union's primary policy, and the court on summary judgment held that the consent to settle provision is part of the Federal policy. So the first argument we've made, Your Honors, is that the court erred in constricting the consent to settle provision into the Federal policy, that the insureds obtained.
Isn't that how all the parties interpreted the policy?
That's not how all the parties interpreted the policy. There is no affidavit from anyone from Federal that that's the way it was interpreted at the time. And to the extent that the insureds interpreted the policy that they needed Federal consent, there was no argument. There was no evidence to say that the insureds believe that the entire consent to settle provision was part of the Federal policy. So that there's two arguments. One is that there's no evidence. The Federal policy is unambiguous, and there's no testimony or evidence from a Federal employee at the time.
Well, let me ask you this, then. Is this an accurate statement by the trial court? It was undisputed that both the insureds and National Union interpreted the policy to require that the insureds request and obtain Federal's consent for any settlement that potentially implicated the Federal policy.
It's an accurate statement as to the insureds and an accurate statement as to National Union. There's nothing in there in which the trial court refers to Federal Insurance Company and whether Federal Insurance Company interpreted its policy at that time to require the consent, because there is no affidavit in the record to determine what Federal's intent was at the time. And the reason why I raise this argument is it goes into the next argument concerning the breach of fiduciary duty and whether Federal Insurance Company owed its insured any duty of good faith in connection with the negotiation and settlement of the Barron Act.
Wait a minute. The question was the judge's description or characterization of the way the insureds and National Union interpreted the policy an accurate statement? Is that a yes or a no?
That's a yes, but I said that's not Federal insurance. I said yes, but I was trying to draw the distinction. The trial court did not say that Federal interpreted the policy the way that those two statements are, that National Union, which is the primary insurer, and the insureds, which is David Shea was representing the insured. So the answer is yes.
Well, is there any evidence that Federal didn't interpret it that way?
Well, we think there is evidence that Federal didn't interpret it that way, because Federal's interpretation is that its policy is not triggered, does not attach until the first layer of insurance is exhausted. So that, and that's the way Federal negotiated the settlement. Federal took the position that it had no duty to its insureds until its primary policy attached. So it is Federal's own actions that
wasn't Federal taking the position that yes, it had the right but not the duty to involve itself in the negotiations, and it could elect not to. But in any event, if there were going to be negotiations in which it wasn't involved that would eventuate into a settlement, its consent to the terms of the settlement was necessary.
That is the position that Federal took at the time. But we are talking about whether or not. The issue was whether or not its policy would be implicated by a settlement, and whether or not its policy was part of the settlement. Part of the unique nature of this dispute was the high-low settlement that was presented by the mediator. The high-low settlement at the low does not implicate Federal policy.
Yeah, but at the high it does.
That's correct, Your Honor. At the high, it does.
And, in fact, it did.
That's correct. That's because the Hilco parties prevailed at the arbitration in which they proved that the insured should have known, in which they proved that the insureds, being the senior officers and directors of Payless Gasway, should have known that, in fact, Mr. Stout was misrepresenting financial information when he provided certifications to the lenders. So the answer is yes, it did at the high, but there was a trial before Federal's policy was implicated, and there was a verdict before Federal's policy was implicated. So the question is whether or not the entire, all of Federal's consent rights are included into, and those rights being the rights that are set forth in the National Union policy. I want to move on to experts because I think that is a very important part of this case, because in addition to our position on experts is that the trial court deprived Hilco of a fair trial by allowing Federal's expert to testify that, in effect, Federal's conduct was consistent with custom and practice, and at the same time depriving Hilco of the opportunity to submit a rebuttal expert. The trial court's ruling on first admitting Mr. McCarrigan's testimony was not supported by any written decision other than the court's ruling from the record and various emails sent to counsel. And I know I've reserved 10 minutes, and I'd like to do that. I think I can address these arguments on rebuttal as well. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to just frame the context in which this appeal arises. The Hilco parties, who are strangers to our insurance contract, induced our insureds to agree with them that they would settle the underlying lawsuit without requesting or obtaining our consent. They did that at the December 7th mediation, and our insureds agreed that night that they would settle the case without our consent, and they, in fact, did settle the case without our consent. Now the Hilco parties are coming in and questioning the manner in which we attempted to exercise our right to consent under the policy, which was totally irrelevant and immaterial to the settlement. That's the context in which the appeal arises. I'd like to address the point that Mr. Eagle was asked about from the bench, and that is, what exactly is the contention of the Hilco parties with respect to the applicability of the consent clause? And he was asked, do you agree or disagree that all of the parties to the contract interpreted it the way in which Federal argues that it should be interpreted? And in his reply brief at page 7, Mr. Eagle says, Hilco does not dispute that the parties to the excess policy and National Union all understood that this settlement required Federal's consent. So that question is answered in his brief. The second question is, does the consent clause apply at all? And below, in summary judgment, the Hilco parties made two arguments. The first argument was that the consent clause didn't apply at all because it uses the term the insurer as opposed to Federal, and it's in the primary policy. And the court rejected that argument, and that argument was not raised on appeal. The only argument below that is raised on appeal is whether the fact that our policy does not attach until the primary policy fully exhausts its layer, does that preclude us from relying on the consent clause? And again, there's no dispute on that issue. In his opening brief on page 21, Mr. Eagle said that the critical issue that the trial court overlooked was that the terms and conditions of the National Union policy are only part of the Federal policy after the underlying limits are exhausted. So Hilco agrees that the consent clause in the primary policy is, in fact, something that we can rely on. And the argument that they make on appeal is that unless and until the insurance policy at the primary layer exhausts by payment, we're somehow not entitled to rely on that provision. As we've established, all of the parties interpreted Federal's right to give consent to the settlement in the way that it was attempted to be exercised. And under Missouri law, that's dispositive. Secondly, there is no ambiguity in the policy.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
Because I'm having trouble understanding what transpired here. Federal doesn't contest the fact that it had, what was it, second layer liability?
That's correct, Your Honor.
For the after $10 million, is it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Federal knows that there's a lawsuit going on and there are claims of significant damages. And then the parties discuss a settlement, and that involves having a high-low figure.
Yes, Your
where
Honor.
Clearly the high figure impacts your policy, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
You knew about that, right?
The proposal was the proposal was communicated to us after the insureds agreed that they would settle on that basis without our consent.
Okay, but what I'm trying to understand is why would Federal abstain or refuse to participate in discussions about how to resolve the underlying lawsuit when Federal is on the hook at the second level?
I understand your question, Your Honor. The evidence in the case was that prior to this mediation on December 7th, defense counsel evaluated the case. He was sending constantly reports to the federal claim analyst about his evaluation of the case. And prior to that mediation, he advised Federal that the maximum settlement value of the case was between $5 and $7 million, which was within the primary layer. At the same time, the evidence is undisputed that the primary insurance carrier advised Federal that it valued the settlement value of the case to be $3 to $5 million, and that it was not going to tender or offer to pay its limits at this mediation. Federal was initially going to go to the mediation, but then had a discussion with defense counsel and the primary carrier, confirming that defense counsel would not recommend a settlement that would exceed the primary, and that the primary would not pay it. And the question was raised, does it make sense for us to be there? We don't want to communicate to the plaintiff's lawyers by our presence
that, right.
that
okay.
we all think it's higher.
All right, but so now I understand why you don't show up to begin with.
Correct.
But then somehow, all of a sudden, everybody who said it's 3 to 5, 5 to 7, no greater than 10, all of a sudden they're coming up with a cap of, what, 15.5 or something?
That would be the high figure, yes.
Where does that come from if everybody had agreed that that was not a possibility?
At the mediation, the mediator proposed this resolution for the case in consultation with National Union's lawyer. And what the proposal was, defense counsel had advised Federal throughout the case that there were very, very substantial defenses to this case. First and foremost, he advised Federal that a prerequisite for finding the directors, this was a lawsuit against the directors for a loan made to the company. And defense counsel said, there must be actual participation in the wrongdoing by these defendants in order for them to recover. The person that,
okay,
I'm sorry.
I understand how people can have their theories and all that kind of thing. I'm trying to come to grips with the idea that the parties, or at least some of the parties, some of the interested, those who have an interest in the result, maybe they're not parties, but they go to a mediation and come out with a number that implicates Federal, and you're saying that Federal didn't know about it and nobody thought that they needed to discuss it with Federal, and that they reached an agreement without consulting Federal.
Let me see if I can answer. I think I understand the question now. At the mediation, at the end of the day, there were discussions all day about whether the case would settle. The primary carrier refused to offer any money towards a straight settlement, much less its policy limits. And the Hilco parties refused to make a demand that would be within the primary limits. So a discussion was had, and this high-low proposal came up. And there are two aspects to the high-low. One is the high and the low on the damages, but the second is how do you decide who gets the high and who gets the low. And they picked an issue which relieved the insured, relieved the Hilco parties of having to prove actual participation, reliance, causation, damage. It was a very, very one-sided issue from Federal's perspective. When that was proposed to defense counsel that night at the mediation, it was 7 o'clock West Coast time, 10 o'clock East Coast time. When it was proposed to him, he said, I can't do this without Chubb's consent because it impacts Chubb's policy. It's 10 o'clock on the East Coast now. I can't reach them tonight. I'll call them first thing in the morning. Hilco said, no, we want the deal done tonight. And one question they've never answered throughout pretrial, trial, appeal, why couldn't they wait until the next morning? But they said, no, we want to do the deal tonight. And defense counsel said, I can't. I have to get Chubb's consent. And so what they did was they induced him to do it by saying, if you agree to this deal tonight, we will agree that we will not seek to recover the high or the low from your insureds. You'll have complete immunity. You'll assign your rights to the policy to us. We'll go after the excess carrier. So from defense counsel's perspective, it's a great deal. His clients have no exposure. He's done his job. So that's why this is attractive to him.
So in that sense, it was a collusive settlement.
That was one of the issues we raised below, potentially for collusion, but it was not pursued at trial. Why was it attractive to the primary carrier? Well, defense counsel said, I think a reasonable settlement could be as much as 5-7. The primary had about that much left under its policy. If they turned down defense counsel's recommendation and the case blew up, they would be liable. But that doesn't apply to us because we're excess. It was never going to be in our layer. So it was attractive for them because it gave them a way to save potentially some money off of their policy. So they thought that was a good deal. And why was it attractive for Hilco?
Okay, well, wait a second. Now let's, if we can, I'm sorry to be causing you to jump around. But so now they come up with a settlement that potentially does impact federal.
Yes.
Right? And they agree to it before getting your approval, getting federal's approval. Why did anybody come to federal afterwards and say, this is a really good deal, and even though we didn't get to talk to you about it beforehand, you really ought to agree to it because it limits your liability as well, and it presents a limited issue to go to a jury and so on and so forth?
Yes. After the handwritten MOU was signed, and I don't mean, we don't say this in our brief, I don't mean to imply to the court that this was everybody agreed on everything. It was essentially,
right.
It was binding on our insureds. It was an option for the other side to enforce. So our insureds were bound if the other sides decided to go forward. Afterwards, defense counsel did, at the request of the Hilco party, send a 13-page letter to our claim analyst saying, here's the pros, here's the minuses. Our claim analyst studied that letter. The testimony was undisputed, went through all of these things, raised questions with defense counsel and said, you said we have terrific defenses to this case. Why are we agreeing to this standard? Why don't they have to prove actual participation? In terms of the damage claim, defense counsel had retained an expert who calculated that based upon the alleged misrepresentations in the inventory certification, the most that the Hilco parties loaned as a result of those inflated certificates was $2.5 million.
Okay, so to make it short and sweet, what you're saying is that from federal's perspective, the settlement that was reached, although it did limit the total that federal might be responsible for, it didn't cover the full $10 million of second level of coverage, it did eliminate what federal considered to be significant defense issues that could have precluded all liability and instead expose them to $5.5 million of liability that federal had good reason to feel was not a favorable result, considering all the factors.
Although it was $7.2 million,
okay.
Your Honor,
whatever.
Because of the exhaustion of the policy. But yes, they considered and reasonably withheld their consent to the settlement because it transformed what everybody on the defense side said was a case between $3 to $5 to $7 million if everything was litigated. It transformed that into an opportunity for the Hilco parties to get $15.5 million by essentially proving a lay-down hand, should the directors have known.
Okay. And in that regard, federal did not stand, if you will, on the fact that it didn't give its consent before the agreement was reached. Federal took the position that in good faith, we looked at the settlement, even though we hadn't approved it in advance. We looked at it after it was presented to us, and we made a good faith determination that this was not in federal's best interest to participate or to agree to it.
That's correct, except they made a determination that the proposed settlement was not reasonable. And after this handwritten memorandum of understanding was sent to federal, in fact, federal was not going to be a party. So their consent was irrelevant. Multiple drafts of this agreement were then circulated. There was never a signature line for federal. Mr. Eagle himself testified, he was a witness at trial, that Federal's consent was irrelevant, the deal was going to get done. So Federal had no ability to exert leverage to change the terms of the settlement. They did try to negotiate. There was a mandatory...
No, Federal's, let me just make sure I understand that. Federal's consent was irrelevant in the sense that it couldn't, because Federal wasn't a party, wasn't one of the settling parties, it wasn't at the table.
Well,
but it, is that right?
No, what I meant, Your Honor...
But it was relevant to whether or not Federal's, you know, Federal's coverage
would
be triggered.
What I meant was it was irrelevant to the parties that signed the contract as to whether it was going to be approved by Federal or not. The contract provided that it was subject to AIG, the primary carrier's approval. So AIG could say, we don't approve this, the settlement craters. Hilco was allowed to approve the final wording. If they agreed that it wasn't acceptable, they could crater the deal. Our insureds could not. On December 7th, they agreed they were going to settle without consent, and we couldn't. We had no power. Whether we consented or not, the deal was going to get done. So on January 5th, there was a court-ordered mandatory settlement conference in the underlying trial. And Federal, who had never even been provided with any of these subsequent drafts, was going to that settlement conference to participate. And the day before the conference, our claim analyst happened to call the lawyer representing AIG to coordinate flight plans for the trip to Kansas City. And he said, no need for the settlement conference. The parties signed the agreement today. And our claim analyst sent a letter and testified at trial that she was going. She demanded that National Union continue to negotiate, that the high-low was unreasonable for all of the reasons that came out at trial, and that as the excess carrier, they asked everybody to hold off until the next day so that they could sit down with an experienced magistrate, attempt to negotiate a straight settlement. She was coming with authority. The Hilco parties' constant response to this was, well, we made it absolutely clear we would never settle for AIG's policy limits. Two responses to that. One, it was never tested because the limits were never put to them and say, will you accept this? But more importantly, Federal was going to come to the hearing with the ability to pay from its own limits if and when National Union did exhaust. Again, they asked for one more day, just like they did on December 7th. All these people were going to this conference. They said, please hold off till tomorrow. They didn't do that. They signed the agreement, and they said, you're out of luck, which proves that Federal had no ability to negotiate the terms, which proves that their consent was irrelevant to the parties that signed the contract. And the record at trial was very, very clear that the claim analyst carefully considered everything defense counsel told her about the settlement. We introduced exhibits into the record, including defense counsel's letters that showed her handwritten notations. I mean, she was seriously considering this, didn't realize the full extent of the breach until later.
Okay, would it be fair to say then, at least from Federal's perspective, that regardless of whether the trial court found this way or not, that the facts support a conclusion that Federal acted in good faith, which the trial court apparently felt was not a part of Federal's obligation under the circumstances. But if we were to assume that maybe Federal did have such an obligation, is it your view that the facts support that such a finding?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There was no risk of an excess verdict to the insureds once they agreed that they would settle this case because they were getting immunity from the plaintiffs. If I could just briefly address the issue on good faith, we don't dispute that under Missouri law, like the law of every other jurisdiction, every contract has an implied duty of good faith. But the law in Missouri in particular and elsewhere in general is that implied duty is used to fill in gaps in the contract. It's not used to override existing written provisions of the contract, nor is it used in order to impose obligations that the contract itself doesn't have. And the alleged duty of good faith that the Hilco parties have argued in this case are two, and they'd never really kind of picked which one they felt they wanted to go with, but they said we have a good faith duty to negotiate and or to consider a settlement. That's their argument. And the policy addresses both of those issues. It defines what our obligations are with respect to a settlement. It's to not unreasonably withhold our consent to the settlement. And it defines what our obligations are with respect to negotiations. At our option, our insureds agreed with us. At our sole discretion, we have the right to participate in negotiations or not. And the court needs to remember that this is not a duty to defend policy where the insurance company appoints defense counsel and controls the defense and settlement of the case. This is a policy where the insured gets to do that subject only to the consent of the insurance company. And the cases that hold that there are obligations in connection with having to try and negotiate a settlement, for example, all apply to duty to defend insurance companies that have assumed to themselves the right to settle a case and have precluded the insured from doing that. In this case, in the primary policy, as originally written, the fourth paragraph of the defense and settlement provision in the policy, and I'll give the court a cite to that, the original language of the policy said that the insurance company may settle the case if it deems it expedient to do so. That was deleted from the National Union policy by endorsement number 5, which specifically deletes that paragraph. So the parties to the insurance contract agreed that the insurance company couldn't go out and negotiate a settlement. It was up to the insureds. And that's understandable in the context of a D&O policy. I know the court's very familiar with those policies. They often involve high stakes, and the companies want to be represented by their own lawyers and control their own defense. So there can't be implied some kind of a free-floating duty to negotiate that is contradicted by what the parties agreed to in the policy. Long-winded way of saying, if I get back to it, did the evidence show Federal acted in good faith? I think it's undisputed that they did. They carefully considered this. They had articulable reasons that defense counsel agreed with, that primary counsel agreed with, about the value of this case, and they acted upon it. And they tried to negotiate, and they were prevented from doing so. I see I have 16 seconds left. Nothing further. I'll sit down. Thank you very much. It's been an honor to appear before this panel.
The record.
Do you dispute that Federal acted in good faith?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
On what basis? We
dispute that Federal acted in good faith because the moment it was presented with the mediator's proposal, which provided for a low of 5 and a high of 15.5, its sole position was we won't pay till National Union puts up its whole limit. This is the critical, I think, policy issue for this court, is whether or not excess insurers can sit back and do nothing, not negotiate, not consider settlements offers in good faith, until the primary offer limits actually tender. There's a lot of D&O coverage in this court and a lot of disputes about D&O coverage. This court is now deciding if Federal had no duty to negotiate or had no duty of good faith prior to the time that National Union put up its limits, then cases of larger magnitude than this are not going to be settled, because when these settlements occur, all of the insurers have to be involved. The insurer can't say, I'm not putting up any money till you exhaust. I'm not even going to talk about putting money until you exhaust, because National Union is slightly disincentivized to actually put up its whole policy and pay it.
Well, wait a second. The way it was described by opposing counsel was that nobody was contemplating a result that could impact Federal's insurance, because everybody was talking about numbers under $10 million.
That's not accurate, Your Honor. That may be what the defense counsel prior to the mediation believed. Defense counsel went to the mediation, as did counsel for National Union, and they got a wake-up call from the mediator, who's an experienced, well-respected mediator, who said to them, guys, if the Hilco parties can essentially prove the fraud, they can show that there was this fraud, your defense is essentially, it wasn't my fault. That was the defendant's defense in the case, was it wasn't my fault. This major accounting fraud was a lower-level employee. We didn't do it, had no responsibility. And that was the subject of respective summary judgment motions. So what the mediator essentially was communicating, certainly to the parties in National Union for sure, because Mr. Muneer plainly testified that, hey, if that's your defense and you lose that defense, there are some big damages. Hilco was claiming $42 million.
Fine. So you go to a mediation and everybody gets a wake-up call. But Federal isn't at that mediation, right?
Federal could have picked up the phone the next day.
Wait a second.
It got reports from National Union.
Wait. Okay. Federal's not there because they believed, perhaps wrongly, but they believed that they weren't subject to potential liability here. And they weren't going to participate at this point. At the mediation, an agreement is reached.
Your Honor, that's why This court, unfortunately, I don't have the time. This court, there are handwritten documents, handwritten agreements. This court has to study those agreements because there's no way the court can evaluate. Mr. Christensen made arguments to the panel. Those arguments we don't agree with. We don't agree with his portrayal of the factual record. We don't agree with him with the fact with what he said. There is a written, handwritten agreement dated December 7th, which is in the record. The handwritten agreement is not a final agreement. And if, in fact, the insureds committed to the settlement, there is no dispute that no one else agreed with the insureds at the mediation to a binding settlement. A binding settlement was agreed to on January 4th. The record is crystal clear as to that. There could be no settlement, Your Honor, unless National Union signed on the dotted line. Without everybody agreed, unless National Union risked, and of course we've heard about this being a laid-down issue, Your Honor, National Union risked $4.5 million of its insurance on this, quote, laid-down issue, and both the insurance counsel testified he thought he would win. As Hilco's party counsel, there were obviously a dispute as to who was going to, whether they were going to be able to prove that, but it was not a laid-down issue. It was the issue the parties moved on summary judgment. With all due respect to defense counsel's portrayal of the evidence, he's portrayed the evidence in a way that I don't believe is accurate as to what would have been tried. The problem is the jury was never told that Federal had any duty. In fact, the jury was instructed specifically that Federal had no duty to get involved. The jury was told Federal had no obligation to pick up the phone and essentially call the mediator or to learn more about the details, to make any offers of settlement. Federal took one position. Their position was National Union must first exhaust its layer before we get involved. And if this court affirms the trial court's decision, this court is setting a rule that says excess layers don't have to get involved in negotiations of settlement until the primary insurer actually pays out its limits. That's not the way the complicated litigation gets settled, and you would be putting directors and officers at significant risk because there's less incentive for a primary layer to actually write that check for $10 million on the first day if, in fact, they think there is some reasonable basis to withhold their consent.
All right. So is it your position, if you're right, that there was a duty, I guess a contractual duty, for the excess insurer to get involved in the actual settlement negotiations, by not doing that, I gather your argument is that they waived whatever consent right they had. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Under Missouri law.
Excuse me, that the two are tied together and that a fair reading of the insurance policy would lead to the conclusion that they can't just sit on the sidelines and then after the parties negotiate the terms, then decide whether or not it will accept. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that all flows from your side's reading of the insurance contract.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we were, the Hilco parties were prepared to make the argument and, in fact, did make the argument on summary judgment and, in fact, asked the trial court to instruct the jury that Hilco was prepared to argue to the jury that the day after this proposal was presented to Federal, the proposal is in a handwritten document. It's contingent upon the approval of National Union. It's contingent upon the approval of Hilco and Congress. It's contingent upon the approval of an agreement between Hilco and Congress as to the division. It's contingent upon a further agreement between the plaintiffs and the insureds and Hilco as to what was going to happen with excess insurance. All of those provisions were left open. Everybody that testified, Mr. Shea testified at his deposition, it was not a final agreement. I don't need to take issue with the comment that Mr. Shea said he intended to go forward with this settlement because it was good for his clients to intend to go forward with the settlement. He wanted Federal's consent because his clients are now judgment creditors. It is, albeit limited to recovery out of insurance. So he wanted his clients to be protected by Federal. Federal had one position on settlement. Position on settlement is Hilco can agree, if Hilco's willing to agree to 15 and a half, and five or four, and a trial, they must be willing to agree to take something in between. But we don't have a duty to negotiate, Federal, so you, National Union, should do that. And we're imploring you to do that, and that's why, with respect to the settlement conference that was scheduled on January 5th, that's exactly what they told them, Ms. Alsnauer said she told the magistrate, which was 15 and a half and
four.
Excuse
me, counsel, when was the first time in this narrative that your side took the position that Federal was obligated as a matter of contract to involve itself in the negotiation and that a failure to do so or a refusal to do so would operate as a forfeiture of their consent right? When was the first time that position was taken?
We moved for summary judgment in March of 2007.
Did you take that position at any time during the events that led to that preceded the litigation?
Well, I think the events that preceded the litigation.
That's a yes or no.
I think the answer to that question is I don't recall there being testimony that was the subject of any discussion.
So the position you're taking now is one that Federal never knew about at a time when it had the opportunity to decide whether or not, that is, to factor it into its decision whether or not to actively involve itself in the negotiation.
What Federal knew in terms of what the position, Federal knew that the parties
Can you answer the question?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Federal knew that. I will accept I don't know of any testimony from a Federal employee that says that. You're right. You're correct, Your Honor. And I didn't mean to avoid that question. What I was trying to say was in terms of what was known by the parties was Missouri law. And Missouri law, which is what governs this dispute, in the case of Gulf versus Noble Broadcasting, the practice of tendering your insurance policy when an insurance company doesn't offer to settle, when an insurance company doesn't put up its money and doesn't either breaches its agreement by not negotiating, the parties were well aware that under Missouri law there is a practice in Missouri in which parties settle for the insurance and then seek to recover from the insurance company. It's a statute.
Are you saying that it wasn't necessary for your side to give Federal notice of what your contention was or would be because they're assumed to that's all clear under Missouri law?
No. We were required to give them notice. No question about that, Your Honor. And they received notice in a timely fashion. In this case, they were provided with copies of all of the documents in a timely fashion.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.